Alibaba. Shares will start trading on the New York Stock Exchange soon. And today in New York, the company began a roadshow intended to promote its initial public offering. Alibaba is a Chinese company. It sells more than Amazon and eBay combined. And NPR's Shanghai correspondent Frank Langford tells us it began as the project of a former English teacher.
Like most great origin stories, Alibaba's is humble. A decade and a half ago, Jack Ma, a former English teacher, gathered friends in an apartment in the eastern city of Hangzhou and laid out the challenges of trying to develop and dominate e-commerce when only a few million people here were actually on the internet. Here's Ma, captured on video at the time.
Our competitors are not in China, but in America's Silicon Valley. Americans are strong at hardware and systems. But on information and software, Chinese brains are just as good as theirs. This is the reason we dare to compete with Americans.
I'm Porter Erisman, and I'm the director of a film called Crocodile in the Yangtze.
Erisman worked with Ma in the early years of Alibaba. That scene in the apartment comes from Erisman's documentary on the company. He says the key to Alibaba's initial success was providing a crucial service to Chinese manufacturers who made everything from ball bearings to cigarette lighters.
The problem was they had a difficult time finding buyers. They would have to go to trade shows in other countries, or they would have to advertise in expensive magazines.
So Jack Ma built a business-to-business internet platform, and it took off. Next, he created a business-to-consumer platform, a sort of Chinese eBay, where many mom-and-pop operations sold everything from clothing to cameras and cell phones. He named it Taobao, which means searching for treasure in Chinese. There was one problem. eBay had already bought an e-commerce company in China, and it dominated the market.
Today, eBay is truly a global marketplace.
Then CEO Meg Whitman outlined the stakes here in an interview with CNBC.
Our view is that one of the defining characteristics of winning e-commerce companies globally over the next 5 to 10 years will be how successful they are in China.
eBay charged for use of its platform. Ma focused on building customers, not revenue, and offered Taobao services for free. Here, Erisman and Ma discuss a statement from eBay.
eBay already came back with a response saying free is not a business model. And they're saying they're much stronger because they can charge.
That's good. The day when they disappear in China, they will regret for what they said today.
By 2005, Taobao was busy advertising and had passed eBay. It had also found a potential way to make real money.
People were new to the internet. As always in Chinese business, there wasn't a whole lot of trust.
Felix Oberholzer-Ji has co-authored case studies on Alibaba at Harvard Business School.
They came out with Alipay, which was an escrow service that made sure that I would only get paid as a seller if, in fact, I sent some product to the buyer.
And the buyer is satisfied. In the meantime, Alipay, the Chinese equivalent of PayPal, can hold the funds and earn a return off them. Last year, the service's record payment for a single day, just on its mobile platform, was nearly $2 billion. Alibaba's success has turned Ma, a decidedly nonconformist CEO, into an icon here. In 2009, he presided over a rally with 16,000 employees in a stadium in Hangzhou. He rose from beneath the stage wearing a leather jacket, faux mohawk, sunglasses, and a fake nose ring, and belted out this from The Lion King. But China's internet landscape changes quickly, and today Alibaba faces new challenges. In addition to its other platforms, Alibaba runs Tmall, an Amazon-like site where brand name companies sell through virtual stores.
My name is Jongwen Chang, and I'm the professor at China Europe International Business School here.
Chang says some companies now find operating on Tmall, which charges for placement, too expensive and too crowded.
Some of the people who do business with Alibaba start to have a second thought about, is it make sense to go into this gigantic cyberspace and get buried under, you know, hundreds and hundreds of merchants.
Competitors are also teaming up to grab Tmall sales. Another internet marketplace which sells brand name products has joined with a wildly popular messaging app in hopes of taking a big chunk of the mobile e-commerce market. Again, Jongwen Chang.
I think this is going to be the big challenge for Alibaba, because Alibaba doesn't have any meaningful social platform.
Alibaba is still China's undisputed e-commerce champ, but to maintain its big lead, it it's going to have to work harder and harder. Frank Langford, NPR News, Shanghai.
Now to some online help for the fashion challenged, or for people who are just too busy to figure it out. You don't have to be a model to have a personal stylist. You can get a computer to be one for you and sign up on the web for a monthly fee. NPR's Elise Hu tells us these services are catching on.
To try out a men's online personal styling service, I enlisted my editor, Uri Berliner. He knows lots about sports and the stock market. He's clever and always calm in a crisis. But a fashion maven?
Uri is the kind of guy that dresses functionally.
I've never really thought about Uri and the word style.
He wears clean clothes, and that's what's important.
That was NPR's Matt Thompson, Don Gagne, and Lakshmi Singh trying to describe Uri's style. He doesn't take it personally.
Most days I couldn't even tell you what clothes I have on, what color they are.
To try for a more memorable look, Uri got an account on Trunk Club. On the site, a quiz for members starts with a question about your current style level. Clueless, confident, or aficionado. Then you choose stores where you already shop and photos that match the look of clothes you currently wear. You're then paired with a personal stylist. Uri's was Emily Kint, who followed up with a phone call.
Would you like to see outfits pieced together as opposed to just, like, articles of clothing?
Yeah, definitely want to see outfits pieced together. I can't see, like, oh, I should wear this shirt with these pants and these shoes would look good with that. That, to me, is like understanding how to build a rocket ship that goes to Jupiter.
Okay.
Not to be left out, I signed up for a women's service called Stitch Fix. The founder and CEO is Katrina Lake.
As women get busier and busier, I think the idea of going to a mall or even, you know, going to your nearby boutique is a daunting proposition. And there's so much inventory out there, and it's hard to figure out what exactly you should be getting.
Stitch Fix also pairs you with a stylist to choose clothes for you. I pay $20 a box for the styling service. Lake says it harkens back to the days of a one-on-one experience with a store clerk you saw regularly.
Think about what department stores used to be, and a place of wonder and a place of community and a place where you're building real human connections and relationships. All of that really is missing online.
Stitch Fix, Trunk Club, and services like them are trying to recreate personal shopping relationships of yesterday, powered by today's data analytics. On Stitch Fix, you describe your style sensibilities with words like preppy or romantic or edgy. You're presented a series of photos showing clothing and accessories in various styles. You rank those photos, love it, hate it, or like it. Just as Netflix gets to know your preferences based on which films you choose, Stitch Fix uses an algorithm to understand and predict your style preferences.
It's still totally up to the stylist to make the selections for you. But if you say, for example, you're looking for a work dress, the algorithm is going to help her to inform her what work dress is most likely going to work for you based on all of the information that we have.
Customers seem to really like this mix of algorithm and art. Stitch Fix had a customer waiting list for 2 years and now employs 550 stylists. Men's service Trunk Club just got acquired by longstanding retailer Nordstrom. One day, a few weeks after we signed up for styling, our boxes arrived in the mail.
I brought scissors. How about that?
Uri, I will say your box is much bigger than
it's
mine.
It's way bigger.
Inside my box, five items and a personalized note from my stylist, Layla.
Have fun trying on all of these great pieces. I'd love to style you again soon. XO, Layla, who is my stylist, who I've never met.
Uri got a box filled with two shirts, two sweaters, a jacket, four pairs of pants, dress shoes, and striped socks, and a lovely shade of lavender.
Those are very stylish.
Are they stylish?
Yeah.
I've never worn purple socks in my life, so...
But you have to kind of take a risk.
Do the clothes work? You pay for what you keep and send back what you don't. And I kept three of my five pieces. Earrings, a military-style jacket, and black skinny jeans from a designer I hadn't heard of but loved. For Uri, a noticeable look did emerge. He says all the feedback has been good.
An improvement. A definite improvement.
But his new threads will cost him. A button-down shirt from his trunk is $185.
I have one of those from Old Navy that cost $25, probably. So
the shirts are going back, but he's keeping the shoes. Elise Hu, NPR News.
The recent exposure of nude photos of celebrities taken from their Apple iCloud accounts is very different in some ways from many of the other hackings we've heard about lately. When hackers steal credit cards, like that major breach last year at Target, the expense can be absorbed by their retailers and banks. Credit cards can be canceled to contain the damage. But in this case involving Apple, just about all of the impact falls on the phone and photos owners, like actress Jennifer Lawrence. Simply put, you can't take back the images once they're out there. Joining us now is NPR's Aarti Shahani. Good morning.
Good morning.
So obviously we need to say that these celebrities were victimized by the hackers. Their private photos were stolen. But is there a larger lesson here, simply that nothing is private in the cloud?
I mean, that's one lesson, and some people are saying don't trust the cloud, but it's also kind of unrealistic given how much people like to view and upload their data from anywhere. But there is a way to have convenience as well as a lot more security. So if you take this analogy, when you've got family jewels and you put them in a bank vault, it takes more than one key to get in. There's your key and the bank's and then some ID checks. So when you're putting more and more piles of valuable data into online vaults, like pictures and financial information, there should be more keys to protect that data. And a lot of people say more keys and a better lockout procedure would have prevented the Apple hack.
Okay, we keep calling this a hack, but in fact, Apple denies that any breach has actually happened.
That's right. Apple put out a statement that was very carefully worded and, you know, many would say intentionally vague. And Apple said that according to the cases they've investigated, hackers didn't breach iCloud or Find My iPhone. But it's entirely possible that another computer program that talks to iCloud, for example, was breached. So hackers could get the data they wanted that way. And NPR asked Apple about this possibility. The company hasn't denied it or ruled it out publicly yet.
And if you don't want sensitive stuff on Apple or Google servers, does deleting it from your phone mean it won't go to the cloud? Say you've got a naked selfie on your smartphone. Can that ever really be private?
No, listen, there is no such thing as a completely private naked selfie. On a smartphone, it's basically a myth. A user has to take explicit steps to disable what's called automated backups. Otherwise, Apple and Google are copying every picture to their servers. And it's really common in these phone-related breaches for the hackers to target those backups. One expert I interviewed wants tech companies to create a new feature. So say I click delete on my phone, I should be offered the option to permanently delete the file from everywhere, from backup, from temporary folders, so that I know it's really deleted. And he says, as customers, we have a right to this.
I mean, I guess the ultimate question is, has Apple really done enough to protect its customers?
Well, I mean, there is a way to protect an account through a process that's called two-factor authentication. So basically, you have a password that you use to get into your account, and then separately, you might have to reply to a text message on your smartphone to confirm it's really you. So this two-factor process is something that Apple has introduced into iCloud. They could do a more thorough push to make sure that people, especially, you know, high-target people like celebrities are using it. And probably now the word is out that people have to use stronger processes.
All right, that's NPR's Aarti Shahani in San Francisco. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Since May, Amazon and the publisher Hachette have been locked in a public battle over the pricing of ebooks. For customers, it's meant that Amazon won't let them pre-order books by popular authors such as J.K. Rowling and James Patterson. And it's upset many Hachette authors because it's made their work less available. So why is Amazon doing this? As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, the company is willing to risk upsetting some customers and authors temporarily as it pursues a long-term strategy for books.
Among those people who Amazon has managed to tick off is Comedy Central host Stephen Colbert.
Now, I'm not just mad at Amazon. I am mad Prime. Because I just found out that they are deterring customers from buying books by Stephen Colbert. And as any longtime viewer of this show knows, that's me.
Colbert is one of many prominent authors that's weighed in on the dispute. 900 writers, including John Grisham and Stephen King, signed an open letter to Amazon and took out a full-page ad in the New York Times. The two companies are fighting primarily over ebook prices. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos wants to sell almost all ebooks for $9.99, and Hachette wants to vary the prices, says Tim Baharin, president of the high-tech consultancy firm Creative Strategies.
Jeff's ultimate position is that
instead of selling 100,000 copies at $14.95, you would sell 200,000 copies, let's say, at $8.99 or $9.99.
In a statement, Amazon says ebooks should cost less than traditional books because publishers don't have to pay to print, store, and distribute physical objects.
What Bezos is arguing is that it's really two different business models, that ebooks are a different business model as opposed to the business model of traditional publishing. And I'm going to tell you, I will be really surprised if Jeff backs down on this.
But for traditional publishers, these are not two different business models. Ebooks are part of the larger book business. It may cost the same to print paperbacks, but that doesn't mean they should all sell for the same price, says Walter John Williams, who is a science fiction author that's published some books with Hachette.
It's sort of like selling arts and crafts. Each book is individual. Some books do incredibly well as cheap ebooks. Some books do really well as hardbacks. Some do really well as both. What I would like to see is for the market to remain open to all possibilities.
And as it stands right now, the market remains mixed. The number of independent bookstores is on the rebound after a low point in the 1990s, though it's probably been helped by the demise of Borders. Michael Tucker, the owner of independent bookseller Books Inc. in San Francisco, says his business is growing.
Right now is the best time that we've seen in 15 years for us not being the ones that are getting crushed. It's interesting because who would have thought that there'd be actually more room for independents to be able to flourish, and the publishers don't want us going away. And the public, quite frankly, doesn't want. It's not like people aren't looking for bookstores.
And while young people are still more likely to have read an ebook than their elders, 62% of 16 to 24-year-olds prefer physical books, according to a poll by youth marketing firm Voxburner. But by pricing ebooks lower, Amazon could ultimately hurt the independent sellers and the market for physical books. Tucker worries that customers will simply start buying ebooks because they're cheaper. People like Therina Rose, an author and illustrator.
At this point, when I'm looking for a new book, because new books are $26 or more, I might end up getting an ebook just because of the cost.
But when it comes to her own book, The Heartbreak Diet,
that is a different story because I feel like my book, because it's a graphic novel, it really was meant to be read as a paper book.
And yet, Rose says even if people don't have that full paper experience, she'd rather they buy the book as an ebook than not buy it at all. And that is clearly the sentiment that Jeff Bezos and Amazon are banking on. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
A new season and new technology. The NFL opens tonight with a game between Green Bay and Seattle. The league and a Silicon Valley company have teamed up to give information-hungry fans and coaches a whole new raft of data. Players will be wearing sensors that track their movement and speed. The hope, as we hear from NPR's Tom Goldman, is to provide a deeper understanding of the game.
Yes, the NFL is America's most popular televised sport, but the league didn't hire guys like Vishal Shah to sit around and be satisfied.
The presentation of the game, the availability, the statistics that we collected, it's been relatively static for the last decade.
Shaw's the NFL's VP of digital media.
Even in the presentation, there hasn't been a substantial enhancement since the first and 10 yellow line introduced into the broadcast.
The itch to innovate beyond that superimposed yellow line you see on TV games led Shaw and the NFL to Zebra Technologies in San Jose, California. Zebra's Jill Stelfox says before her company got down to business developing the new NFL player tracking system, it had to change the Zebra mindset.
We deal with Fortune 500 customers.
And hospitals.
Helping them make life and death decisions. The military.
Delta Force and Navy SEALs use Zebra tracking devices in training.
And so it's really serious.
Not in the Zebra conference room, however, where the company embraced its new NFL clients by slapping on the walls several fatheads, those life-size player cutouts. So under the watchful gaze of star quarterback Eli Manning and others, Stelfox picks up and describes a quarter-sized sensor, or tag. Two of these will be attached to every NFL player's shoulder pads this season.
There's some circuitry inside here, a computer board, and there's a battery. And these tags can blink 25 times a second,
sending tiny radio frequency transmissions to receivers planted around stadiums. We're taking a shortcut here, but these rapid transmissions ultimately turn into squiggly lines trailing players on a video screen, like the ones on Mike King's computer at the Zebra offices. King is in charge of the entire NFL deployment this season. He's demonstrating player tracking during a kickoff in an NFL game. King shows how a coach would use the technology as a training tool, noting how the line behind one player shows the player ran backwards.
He's taking a really inefficient route. So if he had just run across the front, he would actually now be further up so he could act as a better blocker.
The sensors also relay real-time data on speed and acceleration.
If they think a player is slower than normal, if they want to point out an opposing player who may be faster than you appear, there'll be data right there that they can display on the screen that says exactly what that is. They'll be able to say, you may think he's slow, but look at this acceleration.
Ultimately, the plan is to make the information available to fans as well. Those who go to games will get a more comprehensive package of data than those who watch on TV. It's the NFL's way to get fans off the couch and into a stadium seat. And the next generation stats could be a treasure trove for info-obsessed fantasy football players. But even in football, can there be TMI? Could the glut of information be used the wrong way? George Atala is an executive with the Players Union.
Absolutely. We always have that concern.
Concern that the data will be used selectively when judging a player's value or revealing an injury.
Medical information being released into the public that we don't necessarily want out there. And frankly, some of the teams, just on the performance side, might use some of this technology against players in contracts.
Atala says the union will monitor the new technology, which, he adds, has a ton of benefits. The NFL will roll out the player tracking throughout this season, gathering the data internally and showcasing some of it on football broadcasts. It's not expected to be fully accessible to the public or to coaches and teams until next season at the earliest. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
This week, some Ferguson police officers started wearing body cameras, small video recording devices attached to their lapels. The officer who shot Michael Brown was not wearing one. Had he been, perhaps we'd have a clearer picture of what happened, says criminologist Michael White.
Body-worn cameras provide a permanent video record of what happens during a police-citizen encounter.
White wrote a Justice Department report on the use of this technology. He says more research is needed, but there are signs that recording video of those run-ins can change the behavior of police officers, civilians, or both. The strongest evidence comes from the Police Department of Rialto, a city in Southern California.
What we saw with the Rialto study is that the officers who wore cameras experienced significant changes in a couple of different dimensions. First of all, there was a really remarkable drop in complaints against officers who were wearing cameras. We're talking on the order of 88 or 90%. That is truly remarkable. The other finding, which is also nearly as large, is officer use of force. Officer use of force also dropped, not quite as a big drop as the complaints, but also really, really substantial drops. So a lot of people have been talking about those findings and suggesting that when officers wear cameras, it changes the dynamics of the encounter. The term I use is it has a civilizing effect. That is, officers are less likely to engage in rude or inappropriate behavior, and citizens are less likely to be aggressive and resistive.
So what are some of the downsides that people cite? Some pretty pragmatic concerns, I would guess.
I think the first to address is privacy. Clearly, there are times where citizens have an expectation of privacy that could potentially be violated by a police officer's use of a body-worn camera. There are also, I can think of a number of citizen encounters with police that it would be inappropriate to record. The interview of a child, the interview of a sexual assault victim, for example.
There are so many conversations a police officer has with citizens or victims of a crime where that person may not want to be recorded, may be reluctant to talk candidly if they're being recorded.
That's absolutely correct. Perhaps a police officer's talking to a confidential informant or talking to someone else trying to get intelligence on criminal activity. You know, the fact of the matter is that when that encounter is recorded, it becomes in many places a public document that can be requested by citizens, by press, and certainly by prosecutors. The other dimension of privacy involves officer privacy, and it's clear now that police officers and police unions have not universally embraced this technology. They have concerns as well. They have concerns about when cameras will be on and off, when supervisors can go and review footage, and then perhaps most importantly, how are you going to store the tremendous amount of video data that's generated by officers wearing these cameras?
Some police chiefs say it's not a question of if, but when this becomes a major part of policing. What do you think?
You know, I think that that is true. There are 18,000 police departments in the United States. And if you look at the estimates of some of the primary manufacturers or vendors, there may be as many as 5,000 departments now that have experimented with the technology. So I think that given the events that have transpired over the last month, I think that there could be widespread adoption of body-worn cameras by police departments over the next couple of years.
And we do know that one department that is just starting to use the cameras is in Ferguson. I guess no surprise there.
That's correct. And, you know, the Phoenix Police Department, they went through a process to review all the evidence, to engage all the stakeholders. So they took about 9 months from start to finish before officers started wearing cameras in the field. And the death of Mike Brown was less than a month ago. So they are certainly moving at lightning speed. And my hope is that they have worked through some of these concerns that we've talked about. Otherwise, they may have additional issues arising that they're going to have to deal with.
Dr. Michael White, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Don.
Dr. White is a criminologist at Arizona State University. And this note about an issue with the use of body cameras by police in New Orleans. The NOPD started issuing cameras to officers back in April, but a report out this week shows they're only recording about a third of interactions between officers and civilians. The report cites issues over, quote, proper use, making sure the cameras are functional and that officers are turning them on when they're supposed to. The NOPD says it will address the issues.